Welcome to T-Smack, home of the T-Smack. May I take your order?
Welcome back, everyone, to another episode of Talking Smack, where we talk superheroes, movies, animation, comics, and much, much more. I'm your host, Josh Scar, and joining me, as always, is my furry little tabaxi friend, Alex. Alex, how you doing?
I'm doing fantastic. I'm just a little confused as to why you have jogging shoes on, and you got these little tight little lacquer pants, you got the water-wicking shirt on. What are you doing?
It's what's going on? Spring in the Midwest, man. It was 38 degrees today. Sunny, with a light wind. We might as well be opening up the pools.
Oh, that's true. I just was looking outside today, and I was watching all these turkeys walk by my household, wondering why they're on migration.
I saw a couple of them outside my kid's school the other day, and yeah, they're huge already. Like, they're ready for Thanksgiving again.
Yeah, and they can fly. They hopped over my fence, flew up onto my shed, and then took off into the neighbor's yard.
It's like seeing an owl's legs. Like, you're just not prepared for it.
No.
So, Alex, we have a couple of things to get to before we start doing our main conversation. First and foremost, we have to congratulate Godzilla Minus One for winning the Oscars. They won all the Oscars. They were only nominated for Best Visual Effects, but they won all the Oscars somehow.
That is 100% win rate, and they need to just retire right now.
I sent you and Justin the picture in our group chat of the one guy from the Godzilla Minus One team who brought like a mini golden Godzilla who's wearing a bow tie. I thought that was fantastic. I hope that came up on the stage.
Oh, I hope so.
I'm not watching the Academy Awards, not out of protest or anything, but I have no horse in the race this year, so I just don't care. Like, Angela Bassett still got robbed last year. I'm going to die on that hill. Just like Moana got robbed the year Zootopia won. And I'm just going to move on with my life because, I mean, more or less these awards are meaningless. They mean nothing in the overall long term anything. Like, they get to put Academy Award winner on their box art if they haven't released the DVD yet. But for the most part, no one cares about these things anyway other than movie buffs and people who weirdly get invested in certain films. And just like the biggest just middle finger to society ever when Suicide Squad in 2016 won for best makeup
over Star Trek.
Seriously. And I think that was Star Trek Beyond too, if I remember. And that was the one where they had the lady with like the face hugger makeup on the back of her head. And that was all practical. That was a mechanical effect. They didn't CGI that.
And they didn't reveal Idris Elba was in the movie until the end of the movie, even though he'd been in the most of the movie.
Star Trek Beyond was good. That was a really good movie. And it's probably the best of the new Trek too.
Easily.
New Trek movies, I should say.
Oh, easily.
There's not a wasted scene. There's space surfing with it's not the Enterprise, it's a new ship, but it's still so good. Even me as a non-Trekkie, I was like, yes, this is very good.
It captured some of the original series and the Next Generation kind of feel of the beginning montage where they're just space is boring, we keep traveling, been out here for 3 years, dear Lord, what is, you know, we want to go home, the monotony. I distinctly remember an episode where it ended on a shift change and Data like takes over because he doesn't need to sleep. So he takes over for like the night shift change, and you see the main cast leave. Data stays there, goes to like the captain's area, and then a bunch of other, you know, officers appear and they dim the lights because it's night watch. And I was just like, that is a lovely little detail that just adds so much to the world, because of course we're only watching, you know, we're only seeing our cast, our shift doing the awesome shit or getting called in because, oh crap, stuff's going down, and then they all take their spots. But no, there's a night shift there, you know, they dim the lights. Maybe they put on some mood music. Half the screen is like, you know, space, the other half of the screen is like a movie.
That does raise a great question. What does the night shift do during some of these more all-encompassing shenanigans, I'll have to ring Matt and find out. He'll have a good answer. Maybe Leo.
Yeah, that would be great. It turns out it's like, well, actually, if you look at Star Trek Beyond and you look at the actual suits that they're wearing, you actually see the night shift officer was killed when they landed. And then you actually see the mid, you know, the midday crew is actually right there in that back shot. It's like, do they not get a say? Do they not get a vote?
The night shift crew, they just sleep in the escape pods just in case. their rooms, their apartments are escape pods just in case.
There's actually a protocol when they're separating the saucer section from the main part. They have to wake up the night crew to get out of the pods. Quickly, to the saucer section. We're abandoning your pods. We're all way off topic.
So I have to take a victory lap before we move on any further into our promo and then our main discussion point. Last week, I thought we reviewed Dune 2, Dune Part 2, Tune, whatever you want to call it. And I had mentioned that I did not understand if Paul is supposed to be the good guy. Like it just felt wrong the way he was portrayed. And sure enough, by Tuesday morning, I believe is the Hollywood Reporter came out and said, or came out with a piece that was talking about how Frank Herbert. I was going to say Frank Welker, but I'm pretty sure he's Scooby-Doo or Fred.
Or both.
He's I know he's Megatron or Starscream.
He's or both.
Yeah. I know he's also I can't remember the name of the species now, but he's the voice of the main bad guy in Dino Riders, which that keeps coming up in my brain for no reason right now. I have some notes. Had a really fun episode with the IP lottery, and I submitted Dino Riders as one of the lottery pieces.
Yeah.
I know a lot of people have been, the nostalgia kick for Dino Riders has been around. There's been a few podcasts that have talked about it, but like apropos of nothing, I have just been thinking about Dino Riders and I'm just like, why? There's nothing in my life that is dealing with anything related to this right now, other than like my deep desire to write a story script, like a manuscript for a Dino Riders movie and then have someone else script it out. But I don't have those connections unless James Writes Scripts is listening, which James, if you're listening, let's collaborate. I know you're in TV, but let's make that jump to movies together.
You guys can bring it back. You can bring it back. It's going to be fantastic. It only had one season, but you have the show Bible ready for like six seasons in a movie.
We can pull a George Lucas and just go
merchandising where the real money from the movie is made.
And that's how we make our millions, as we bring back Dino Riders. The 40 and 50 year old crowd that would buy those toys up in an instant would just pay our mortgages for the rest of our lives. I'm way off topic from taking a victory lap for thinking of Dune. So anyway, Dune Part 2, Frank Herbert, Frank Welker, whoever it is, he wrote Dune Messiah or whatever the Dune sequel book was.
Messiah, because he
wrote that book because people did not understand that Paul Atreides was not a hero. He became like this pulp hero, cult hero, and Frank Herbert was like, no, that's not what I did here. He's a religious zealot who manipulated people who believed in him into ascending to power. And now I have to write a whole new book explaining this to you dumb nuts.
Go on your lap, man. I'm waiting for you to run.
I'm taking the win because without knowing it, I watched Dune properly. Yeah. I was supposed to feel icky about how Paul ascended and how he decided to grab power, and I'm happy about it. I will take the fact that I have some kind of what's the word I'm looking for?
Literacy, yes, emotional media, depth.
Media literacy. That's the word. Thank you. I can't think of media literacy, but I have it.
Exactly. All right, everyone, Josh has begun rounding the bases, so I'm going to just lean in here a little bit. So as we all know, it is not black and white. Paul Atreides is not the hero, but he's also not the villain. There's a lot of machinations that were at play. They had the Bene Gesserit who were working things. You have his mother who was working things. You have the fact that he was looking for revenge against the Harkonnens because his entire family line was wiped out, including his best friends like Duncan Idaho and some of the others that were wounded.
What a name, so, Duncan Idaho.
You're running bases, Josh. So so what we have to work on here is the fact that it is a complex morality story that is taking the typical rise of the Messiah figure and the prophecy and working it against the normal expectations, which is the Messiah is always right. Now, whether or not Dune Messiah Part 3 actually kind of leans into that or plays with the morality tale a little bit more, we don't know. But yes, Josh has media literacy, unlike all the idiots out there who are like, who's like, boy is cute, boy kiss girl, boy get revenge, boy good, right? Boy good?
No. Nope. White male equal hero.
Why did boy stab Elvis? I liked Elvis. Congratulations, Josh. You rounded the bases. You did one more.
You know, Alex, while I was rounding the bases, I heard you talking, but all I heard was
rage. Rage.
Quiet, Beppo.
All right, we're gonna hear. We've got a Game Club Pod style preamble happening here, and coincidentally enough, we have the Game Club Pod as our promo for the week. So we're gonna hear from Joey, Tim, and Slade, and we will be right back.
Join me, Joey, and my co-hosts,
Tim
and Slade,
at the Game Club Podcast, where every 2 weeks we review video games not too dissimilar from a book club. Looking forward to seeing you there, idiots.
Yeah, you stupids.
Tim, do you want to jump in on this?
I will not bandwagon audience abuse.
And we're back, and I just have to say, Slade was trying to troll me. We're recording today, March 10th, Mario Day, and Nintendo confirmed that there will be a Super Mario Brothers 2 movie and that they're building towards a Mario cinematic universe. Not like a Nintendo cinematic universe, but a Mario cinematic universe, which feels so on point after that movie, that vanilla ass movie, that they would just be like, MCU sounds good. No one has that, right?
Oh boy.
I think Slade got mad because I said I had a sneak peek at the script and it was just someone holding up a vanilla ice cream jug. Like, if you enjoy that movie because it's full of Easter eggs and things you love, and it's a very okay movie. I don't know what else they could have done to make it better other than get rid of Peaches and also get rid of the stupid soundtrack and use actual music from Nintendo. I don't know what they could have done plot-wise to make it a better movie. I have hope that they can improve on it and grow, but I have also have no hope that they're going to do anything original considering its Illumination. And that is my very concise review of Mario from last year.
Wahoo!
So we're here to talk about Avatar: The Last Airbender 2024. And Alex, you're going into this cold. You have not seen the original Avatar: The Last Airbender, the animated series.
Nope.
Have you seen the movie?
There was this dark period in my life I don't remember. It was about 95 minutes. And I
was that Madam Web?
Oh, thankfully that was only 94 minutes. There's a second black period, which is like, I vaguely remember seeing it like 14 years ago, and I just was like, no, so I went in fairly cold. I had watched one or two of the Netflix trailers, and I did want to see it because I wanted to see the big fuzzy thing get petted, and it did get petted, which is
Appa,
nice.
Yes.
Appa, yes. My feelings on it are kind of complex because there is a lot of peaks and valleys in this.
Yes, that's a great way to put it.
Yeah, some of it is the writing, some of it is the acting, which I will never intentionally insult a child actor. I can, however, insult the casting director who did not find appropriate chemistry between our group of child actors. The ending almost completely redeemed it for me, except for one particular thing we'll talk about in spoilers. But I will say that the things, the characters I enjoyed the most was the Uncle Iroh. And June.
Yes.
I love June. I love June. I love her Hound of Tendellus, or whatever that creature was. To me, it acts and looks just like the Lovecraftian Hound of Tendellus that is this like evil dog creature that licks and knocks you out.
Yeah, the Shearshoe.
Yeah. That was fantastic. I love their playful flirting of her to him and how uncomfortable he looks. You know, even though they're fairly age appropriate. I looked up the actress. She's in like her late 30s, and the uncle is what? He's in his early 50s, I think. That was very playful and cute. I loved the mix of martial arts, katas, and forms to waterbending. I mean, to the bending that they're doing. Like, that was fun. At first, I was like, this is so dumb. The Fire Nation attacks, and like, they're doing fireball kickflips and stuff. And it's like, it started to work for me after a while to see the people, like, you know, average person could kind of deflect or block with, you know, some of their own stances or weaponry. Like, they went to that first island and they were using like war fans, and I was like, that was cool. I really like this. And that since they don't have like an active very many active earthbenders there, that they have this elite guard of ceremonial warriors. I was like, this really works for me. The world building more than anything works for me.
Mm-hmm.
But my issue is that the characters seem that more like they're on a travelogue than they are in an odyssey.
Mm. I like that a lot, because that's exactly how I felt after watching the movie. I actually went into the movie cold. I had never seen the animated series. When I got walked out of the movie, I was like, well, that was something. It wasn't good, but it was something. And I sat on it probably for 2 or 3 months. And then randomly I came home from work one day, saw that the series was on Netflix. And I was like, let's see what this is about. I gave it 3 episodes. And then over the course of the next 4 days, since I had a long weekend, I finished the entire series.
Whoa. That's like, is that like 40, 50 episodes?
It's like 70 some episodes.
Wow.
I think it's like 26, 26 and 23. But the final episode, I think, is like 90 minutes long.
And you binge that.
Yeah, I had nothing better to do. I was in my mid-20s and was not attached to anyone. So okay. What else was I going to do with my time?
Play a video game?
I worked at GameStop. I wasn't going to play more video games, especially when Avatar The Last Airbender was on Netflix and I needed to watch it.
So seriously, the cartoon hooked you that much after 60 minutes of 3 episodes, 60 minutes.
Roughly, like... yeah. I was all in. It got me hook, line, and sinker. It's so good.
Okay.
And my review of this is watch the animated series.
Oh.
I don't think that this is as heartless as like some of the Disney remakes.
Mm.
There are genuinely good moments in this, and there's good adaptations of the animated series into this, but the animated series, among other things, because obviously it has 70 episodes to get through this, where it would seem that Netflix is limiting themselves to 24 episodes to do this. They have confirmed since we're recording that they're going to do seasons 2 and 3. I would assume they're going to do them back to back or pretty close together, and hopefully get them done before the actors completely age out of their roles.
Mm-hmm.
And they leave some wiggle room, because one of the plot points is that Sozin's comet arrives every 100 years. It's kind of like Halley's comet. It's on a timeline. You know, can count on it. We know when it's coming. But in this show, they're just like, it'll come soon. we have a general idea of when it's coming.
Okay. I think we would have to get into spoilers for me to ask some of my next questions.
Yeah. I mean, it's a almost 20-year-old TV series. I think we can go full spoilers.
Okay. So one of my main questions that I have regarding this Avatar, the Avatar character, is in the series, does he act like a little bitch and refuse to learn how to waterbend?
That is my biggest gripe about this show besides other, my biggest gripe is Aang is like an anti Peter Parker in this show. He accepts the responsibility, but he doesn't want the power. Where Peter is like, I want the power, but not the responsibility. But he understands that with the power comes the responsibility.
Right.
And I can't tell you how many times in the show, Aang just goes, I have to learn waterbending. I'm the Avatar. I let people down and I'm so sad about it. And I'm mad about it. And I shouldn't even be here. I'm not supposed to be here today. And it just, the show, the animated series, he kind of accepts his fate. I think after episode 3 or 4 is when they do the airbender, the Southern Air Temple, where he sees Gyatso's bones and he has like a big freak out. Cause the running theme of the show is his mission is to learn the elements and become the Avatar. He has accepted that in both versions of the show, but in the animated series, he's still very much also about having fun and being a kid, because that's the whole reason he ran away. He didn't want the responsibility. He accepts that he has the power, but he still wants time to be a kid, because the tradition was the Avatar does not find out that they're the Avatar until they're like 16.
Oh, okay.
But because of the Fire Nation impeding on borders, they have to take drastic measures. And Aang's not emotionally prepared to take on those the responsibility yet, because he's only 11 years old.
Hmm. I think they did a decent attempt at like that Aang is still 12. He was just frozen for 100-ish years. But my issue is that he like walks up to Katara, who is a waterbender from the Antarctica South?
The Southern Water Tribe, yeah. Basically Antarctica.
And she ends up like being given a scroll, and she's practicing her forms from a scroll and getting better.
And he never tries in this.
No, and she even says, like, you want to work together? And he's like, nah.
Nah.
And then starts splashing water on her with his hands.
Yeah.
And even then, like, second to last episode where he channels with one of the other waterbender ghosts.
Avatar spirits, yeah.
Yeah, spirits. And he's like, you have to do it alone. She goes to go to learn, which I did like that kind of thing where she went to go learn forms with the women. And turns out that the women are only allowed to learn healing magics because, of course. Mm-hmm. And but even then, she like storms back over to
Paku.
The bigot leader. And is like, well, then test me. And they get into this fight, which is really cool. I enjoyed watching seeing that. But that is after Aang has been told, you got to kind of do this alone and got to learn how to do waterbend. And he at no point is like, cool. I mean, he could have pulled the, hey, I need to learn waterbend and the Avatar. You guys know I don't know how to learn it. So she just whooped your ass. You teach both of us. You teach. If you're going to make sure I save you, you have to also teach her or something. There could have been like some kind of explanation for him not going, hey, I want to learn.
In the animated series, you're already on to better ideas, which the animated series does. In the animated series, Aang and Katara have been practicing. Aang is like slightly proficient at waterbending.
Oh, really?
But he doesn't have like the same skill level that he should, being the Avatar. So when they get there, Paku, they're like, yeah, let's. Aang and Katara are like, yeah, we're going to learn from the masters in the Northern Water Tribe. It's going to be great. Paku does this thing where he's like, we don't teach girls how to offensively air waterbend. They learn healing magic. That's what they're good for. And Aang and Katara both kind of have a little tiff with Paku about it. And then Katara says, no, you're the Avatar. You need to learn to waterbend. And Aang has the idea that like, oh, and I can teach you at night. We can do it in secret. And I can teach you these things.
Yeah.
And then Paku essentially says, you're disrespecting me and my tribe and my culture. Fuck you. No. And then Katara has like goes off, and I think they do an okay job translating the fight, but this is probably the most heartless part of this show, in my opinion, because the fight between Paku and Katara is very visceral. Katara has no formal training other than what she has learned from the water scroll. And when she goes up against a master, it is just her going on instinct and raw power versus years of teaching. And they recreate that fight for the moments, but I did not feel the same power and anger from Katara or even Paku, because he's like, I'm going to teach a whiny little girl a lesson. That's his motivation in this fight. He's like, you think you can go toe to toe with me? Okay, let's go. And Katara is like, I'm going to prove to you, you misogynist old bigot, that women can do this.
Yeah.
And the fight is very intense, and you see some really cool stuff out of both of them. But in this live action one, as someone who has seen the animated series, they're just hitting the beats. They're like, Katara did this, we're going to do that. Paku did this, we're going to do that. And it, none of it feels authentic. It just feels like this is what people expect to see. We're going to put it on screen. It's done. Moving on.
So I will say I did like that fight. I thought it showed some emotion, like her frustration. But I do see where you're talking about, like, Paku seemed more showing disinterest than anything else. I do get what you're saying, that the cartoon probably had more vengeance to it, more manipulation and want an intention to hurt her versus him just kind of like, whatever, we're still going on. The thing that I did not like about the end of that fight was once it kind of, and it's still, well, she lost, but it kind of got to that stalemate. She was exhausted. He was walking away. And the kids, kind of the other waterbender guys, kind of ran up to her like, where'd you learn the disc thing? I wanted them to stay on her for a few beats more of that moment of appreciation where she's being sought after for her knowledge and her skill. And instead, the camera kind of pans over to Aang and her brother, who were like, oh, okay, she's alive.
She did so great. Hooray.
Yeah, and then she runs over to them and is like, yay. What I noticed was that the others in the background who were like, hey, can you teach us? They're still kind of lingering there. And I guess her background instruction were look excited and clap occasionally.
That was so cool. Yeah. Yeah, there's some weird stuff going on in this show. Weird decisions. And my biggest complaint, besides just adapting an animated thing that does not need to be adapted, is that I got a lot of Ahsoka stunt vibes from the show. And I think it gets better throughout it. And maybe it was intentional, or maybe I'm giving them too much credit, because there are some things, like very early Katara is not, for lack of a better word, and no pun intended, fluid in her bending motions. It's very stiff and she's standing very like tight.
Okay.
And in these forms and in these motions, it's supposed to be like second nature. It's supposed to be just like you're gliding in a walk and you're just moving and you're feeling the water and you're pushing it. But the show just always, it feels more like a very deliberate, and I don't even know how else to put it. It just, it never felt like a natural thing. It felt very forced. And I don't know if it was the choreography, the way they framed it, the fact that they really wanted to make sure we saw that it was the actors doing it instead of stunt people. Right. I don't know, but it felt very stiff and it didn't feel natural. And I'm just like, why can't I see the back of her head and someone in the really nice costume just do this fluid motion and it looks good instead of it looking awkward?
So my next question would be around Sokka, her brother.
Sokka, yes.
Sorry, Sokka.
You mean Riley from National Treasure?
Oh, is that who that actually is?
No, but that, it feels like that was the direction they went with him, because they're like, we can't have him have, he can't have a character journey. He basically just needs to be Riley from National Treasure. We'll give him moments where he gets to have a one-up kind of moment for everyone, on everyone. Like, oh, I figured out this clue. I figured out this thing. Or I got to bop someone on the head. But for the most part, he's just there to make a snarky comment, point out how insane things are, and scream.
Okay. So my question specifically is, I know that The Legend of Korra is like a sequel series.
Yes.
In the sequel series, how many children does he have with how many women? Because in this one, the second episode with Warriors, like, there was a lot of heavy flirting going on. I mean, she even, I really wish I remembered the character.
We're talking Sokka?
Yeah, Sokka and the lady that she plays,
Suki.
Suki, yes. She takes off her makeup and so that she can teach him. And he can't even study the forms because, like, they're next to each other and the close up on the hip grabbing. I'm like, oh, is this going to be something?
The internet got so thirsty for Suki, and I can't blame them. I'm sorry. She is very pretty. I always try to distance it because of the character they're portraying, because Suki and Sokka in this are maybe 16, 18, mm-hmm. somewhere in there. And so I'm like, no, I am almost 40. I cannot do this. So like but the internet, for some reason, not for some reason, God save them, they got very thirsty for Suki. And again, I cannot blame them.
So anyway, then like three episodes later, he mentions, I didn't know she was a firebender when I was making out with her. I'm like, what? And then the end of it, out of nowhere, he's trying to hook up with the three-tailed fox lady. And I'm like, is he Brock? Is this what he is? He has no personality. His personality is I wander and bang.
So they did a speed run with okay. Sokka and Suki, because yes, there is supposed to be chemistry and there's supposed to be a budding relationship. And I believe she does lay a smooch on him when she mm-hmm. does, like, and I'm also a girl, and she'll lay a smooch on him.
Yeah.
But one of the gags that I really wish they didn't reveal right away is that Sokka in the animated series does not see Suki without her makeup until midway through season two.
Oh, really?
She's a security guard working in, I believe it's Ba Sing Se, and she like walks up to him and gives him a hard time, kind of jokingly. And he's like, hey, I'm kind of seeing someone. I don't know who you are. And then she like lays a kiss on him and he's like, Suki.
He knows her by the kiss.
Yeah, exactly. And so he's like lips. Blown away, like, oh my God, she's hot too. Awesome. Bonus.
That warrior makeup is stunning.
They translated that very well. Although I will say that the gold tipping on the inside of the eye mm-hmm. annoyed me, because that's not practical for a warrior to have, like, yeah, it's very elaborate makeup, mm-hmm. but you're not going to do like, okay, we've got the white, we've got the red on the eyebrows. Now a little bit of gold just to accentuate your eyes. You're going to war. You're not going on a first date. You're not going to see the matchmaker. So like that little detail irked me just because it felt very cinematic, and mm-hmm. it broke up the way the makeup worked. Mm. It looked great, mm-hmm. but it's not practical.
So does he make out with every girl to the village they go to?
No, he has, I think, maybe three relationships that they acknowledge. One of them is with like a firebender that he like flirts with and doesn't realize she's a firebender until it's too late. But that one is also a passing joke. We don't get any screen time with that. But season one is supposed to be more about Sokka and Yue. He has a connection with Suki, but there's something about Yue that really just, he falls madly in love with her the moment he sees her. Whereas in this show, I don't even know if they ever really translated into him being in love with her. It's more, he has a responsibility to defend her. And because they're giving him this backstory of being a failed warrior, that his dad's this high chief who is an amazing warrior, and he's just a lowly engineer who makes great devices that people can use and make their lives better, but he can't, he can't hold up a sword and fight. And whatever, in the animated series, he grows as a character and he becomes like, his ingenuity plays into how he fights, and he becomes a great warrior because of how intelligent he is.
Oh, that's cool. I was happy to see that Princess Yue is Amber Midthunder from Prey. That was awesome.
Was that her?
Mm-hmm.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah.
The bad wig just completely threw me off.
Oh, that wig.
That was the wild. That was the second worst wig in the show. The worst wig was Gran-Gran.
Yes.
I'm going to give away one of my notes here, because I'm going to speed run some of my thoughts as we get closer to winding down. Episode one, Gran-Gran.
Mm-hmm.
is framed like a crazy stalker bitch from a horror movie. She's like hand that rocks the cradle. You could just like add in the jump scream loud noise orchestral note mm-hmm. in any scene she's in, and it would work. Ah, Gringred. Oh, Jesus. And why they gave her, of all people, the intro line, because they have to Easter egg the whole air, water, earth, fire, whatever. Everything changed when the Fire Nation attacked monologue. They gave her that, and the delivery mm-hmm. she gave with that. Again, she sounds like an insane person in a horror movie. Like, all she needed to do to make it complete was add thinner at the end of her delivery. And she's setting a curse on them.
So, speaking of the old age makeup, it took me about a minute and a half with, was it King Mori?
Boomy.
Yeah, Boomy. To realize that is Jay from Ghosts.
Yep.
Utkarsh Ambukar.
He's also in Pitch Perfect, which I didn't realize.
He is?
Yeah, he in the first one, he plays Bumper's like hype man. And he ends up hitting it off with the beatbox girl from the Barton Bellas.
Oh, okay. He was having all the fun.
Boomy is such a fun character. And
oh, yeah.
With what they did with him, it is maybe my most disappointing part of this show.
Really?
Because
I liked him.
I liked what they did with him. They kept some of his eccentricities, but the translation didn't work because he's in the live action show, he's lost hope, and he has just become this doddering, old, hateful, spiteful earthbender who's like, war is death, death is coming. And he's kind of emphasizing the change, or what the other avatars are telling Aang, is it's a lonely road. You walk a lonely road, the only road you've ever known.
Yeah.
But in the show, in the animated series, he's just maniacally eccentric, and he's having fun. And the way he puts Aang through a bunch of trials, and he like portrays himself as like this feeble old man with like a hunch. And the moment when he like rips off his cloak, when they do the duel, he's just jacked as shit. Like, he looks like John Cena, and he's just like, let's fucking go. And he's trying to teach Aang a lesson in,
yeah,
he needs to, as the Avatar, he needs to approach things from different angles, from different perspectives, and take in different ideas, which is an amazing teaching mechanic, especially as you progress through the show, when you find out that for Avatars, it's hardest for them to learn the opposite of their natural bending state. So Aang, as the Airbender, has the hardest time learning Earthbending, because air is fluid and open, where Earth is compact and hard.
Okay.
And so Boomy's trying to instill some of these lessons into him, but in this one it's just Boomy being spiteful, and I think there's a way to make that work. Right. I don't know that the show delivered on it completely.
Okay. I kind of got what they were going for, at least how I interpret in the show, which is that his thing is that I'm still alive and I'm barely holding together this kind of like last bastion of defense.
Yeah, and he's lost hope. He's basically just waiting for a moment with where the earthbenders can come in, or the firebenders can come and just take him away, essentially.
Yeah. I did kind of like that the ultimate lesson he was teaching him, which is like, listen, it's either you or me. Like, one of us is going to lead the earthbenders. One of us is going to, like, you know, transition their power from one to the other. And then, of course, it's, you know, the power of friendship allows me to survive this day, kind of thing. Which I did get that. I mean, that was a sledgehammer that kept getting repeated throughout the entire series by every Avatar, which is, there is no power of friendship. But Rainbow Dash is going to be there to let us know.
It's time to be awesome.
Yes, exactly. And, you know, Princess Starlight is going to let us know. So I really only have like one particular question left. And that involves the Fire Nation, which, by the way, Daniel Day-Kim, he is loving that role.
He is pitch perfect as Ozai.
Oh, he...
I don't trust the writers, but he is amazing in that role.
You can tell that he's just like, full villain? Full villain. But aside from that, what is the point of Prince Zoku?
Prince Zuko?
Sorry, Prince Zuko, yes. What is the point of him? Because other than his uncle being awesome and June crushing on him, which is adorable. By the way, I'm hoping season three they get together. Because they gave her one task, which is to hunt down the Avatar.
Fun fact, June in the animated series is voiced by Jennifer Hale.
Really?
Yep. Mm. So many amazing voice actors in the animated series.
I mean, they gave her one job. Her job was, not only did she hunt him down, she took out like six firebenders to get to him. But he like captured and freed and failed. I don't understand. Is he supposed to be this kind of sad sap, kind of like down on his luck? Because the backstory that was delivered in that monologue to the crew aboard the prince's ship, when the prince kind of was like, when he the uncle was like, listen, he gave a lot more than you guys know. I understand he's a jerk, but he actually, you know, spared your lives. And that was, I loved that.
That was one of the better changes into the show from the animated series, because the animated series, it's just a rotating crew.
Oh, really?
Your question actually leads into one of my biggest complaints of the show, and that is Zuko in the live action show feels more desperate than he is determined.
Okay.
In season one, he is the bad guy. Like Ozai.
Oh, really?
Ozai, we only hear about him. We only ever hear about him as the Fire Lord. I think we see the flashback that they talk about, because Iroh's telling the crew about how he got his scar and what it meant, which the burn is a mark of shame. It's very shameful for a firebender to get burned, because they're a master of the element. Why, how the hell did you burn yourself? So the fact that he got burned, it is a big mark of shame.
Okay. So it's not kind of a thing where like, I mean, yes, obviously it's a mark of shame because his father did that to him, but firebenders don't like have like scars from learning.
They shouldn't know, because they should be able to deflect it at the very least, or their body should be able to counterbalance it, because they run hot anyway.
Oh, okay. Okay.
But Zuko in season one, he is the villain, and they kind of transition away from him being the villain by the end of the season because of Admiral Zhao,
mm-hmm.
which, again, fun Avatar fact, number 92 of this episode. In the animated series, Zhao was inspired by Jason Isaacs' character from The Patriot.
Really? Okay,
and
I didn't see that.
The creators actually reached out to Jason Isaacs and said, hey, do you want this role? Because we created it specifically because of you. And so he came in and he did it.
Oh, that is awesome. Okay, that's cool.
What they did with Zhao is another thing I think they did really well in making it different and not exactly the same, because in the animated series, Zhao is just a well-to-do, well-respected commander in the Fire Navy.
Mm-hmm.
And he kind of, because he bumps into Zuko randomly and finds out that the Avatar is still around due to him having his crew just kind of share some drinks, share some talk, and finds out the Avatar is still alive. So now he has this mission to just gain power. Because he's a very prideful, well-to-do guy. So like more power means more respect, means more money, means everything. He's not in, again, we're full of spoilers. So Zhao's motivation in the live action is that he wants to become the new Fire Lord, which is so fucking stupid, because Azula is the one feeding him all this information and building him up.
Yeah.
She's not going to let him become the Fire Lord, and she's definitely not going to marry him. She's 12 and he's like 45.
Oh no, she wants to be the Fire Lord.
Yeah, she wants to be the heir to the Fire Lord. So that plan is stupid on so many levels. I don't like that motivation. But I do like him kind of being this like slimy low-level commander who just, he's the perfect pawn for Azula to use to get to what she wants.
I love that he has a stenographer traveling with him. And he's like correcting the stenographer. And I was like, I was waiting for the joke, because it's an obvious joke when you have a stenographer with you and you're pointing things out that you once said, or like, oh, adjust my speech lines and stuff like that. That when something doesn't go your way and the stenographer notes it down. Don't write that down. You know, I love that.
What are you doing?
That is perfect, because that is the perfect setup and you know it's coming, but it's played just right.
I think Zhao in both versions of this show is a highlight. But to get back to the question about Zuko, in the first season, he is the antagonist. He is the main villain of the show. And it slowly transitions into Zhao because Zuko has an arc to play. But his main motivation for most of that season is, I've got to hunt the Avatar, I've got to restore my honor, and I've got to go home. Mm-hmm. And that is his determination. And he is operating on the belief that the Avatar is hiding somewhere. He thinks he's hunting a 115-year-old man, and he has mastered all the elements, and he's just waiting for a moment to strike. Or he's trying to live like a nomad's life and just live out his days until the Fire Nation can't find him and he's dead. But Zuko has belief that he is hunting the Avatar, that his father would not send him on a fool's errand that would just lead him to living his life abroad.
Okay.
And that's where my biggest problem with the direction of Zuko in the show is. And he's another one who feels very stiff. Like, there are moments where he's supposed to be intense or he's feeling something, and the actor's just standing there with his hands at his side, like, I am feeling things. I can't convey what they are, but there are emotions happening. I don't know if they're sad or upset, but they're happening.
I want to say that part of that is just how gregarious that his uncle is, because Paul Sun Hunyili, hopefully I'm pronouncing that correctly, he is so personable and just so flow with, you know, go with the flow, and he's just fantastic in this.
Yeah, Iroh is a great role, and I think Paul's son, Hyung Lee, was an amazing choice to play that role, because he can convey all of the emotions that are required with Iroh.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to get into my episode notes here, because I can't praise Paul's son, Hyung Lee, enough. When they announced the cast for this,
yeah,
I was upset that they had Ozai and Azula cast, because they're not even supposed to show up until the final moments of the last episode. And they don't even have, Ozai has a few lines, Azula has nothing.
Interesting.
And then Iroh is like the heart of the show.
Okay.
Even with Aang, Katara, Sokka getting into Toph and everything. But like, Iroh is the heart. He's the guy that is just holding the emotional beats of the show together.
Yeah, I don't really have any more notes or anything, like, or questions. The show was very up or down. There were some beautiful moments. I think that the two-part episode with the whole going into the fog thing, that was, unless it comes back up later as being super important, that to me was a fetch quest that they dragged out for two episodes. What I really just want to see is from seasons 2 and 3 is that I want to see Aang start to learn. Mm-hmm. I think he's gone enough of the whole, I was gone, I have now communicated with 3 of the other avatars, with all the other avatars, I haven't learned crap, I almost lost myself without, you know, my friends and a sacrifice bringing me back from Water Godzilla. I want to see him actually study and learn, because mm-hmm. the only person I felt who actually had the agency to study and learn was Katara.
Yep.
I do think it was a little bit of a cheat to, at the end of it, basically call her, she's mastered her work already. But they did give her she's a quick learner and she was studying. And also,
she's supposed to be a prodigy. Yeah. Once she figures it out, she's just full on waterbender Katara.
Yeah. And that's really good. I like that. I want to see Aang now learn. That's what I want from him.
And that's one thing that I don't know why they're not letting him learn, because if I remember, the Northern Water Tribe sequence is 3 episodes, and it's one entire episode is the building up to Katara versus Paku. They mm-hmm. arrive at the Northern Water Tribe. They have their whole thing. Sokka has a rivalry with Han, because Han's just like this surfer dude who's like, I'm totally going to marry Yue. You don't know what's going on, bro. And they just made him this humble dude that, he's as vanilla as they come. He's as vanilla as the Super Mario Brothers script. Sorry, Slade.
Yeah. Princess Yue already broke up with me. I understand if you're going after her, dude.
I am fine being a cuck. Yes.
Yes. Let's fist bump. How many children do you have already right now? Wow, that's a lot.
There's Han is a really fun character to hate because of how invested you get in Sokka in the animated series. Yeah. Cause like he only partially listens to Sokka, cause there's a point where they are asking Sokka about like, oh, what do the firebenders wear? Because, or they're like, we stole these firebender uniforms, and they've got these like big upward spiky shoulder pads and stuff. And Sokka's like, that's not what they wear anymore. And Han's like, what do you mean? We stole these off of firebenders. Like, where? In the firebender graveyard we have over in the wasteland. Like, yeah, they haven't worn these for 100 years, man. And so then Sokka's like updating them on who Zhao is. And Han finds a way to get into Zhao's ship. And he's like, Admiral Zhang, you're going to get your ass beat. And then he gets flown out the window.
That's funny.
They butcher so many characters in the name of speed running some of these storylines, but let's get into my notes. This is going to be a little bit of a longer episode, but I'm going to speed run some of these. And then again, if Alex has anything, we'll bring it up.
Go for it.
So episode one, first notes are the extended raid on the Air Temple from the prequel era before Aang gets lost. Extended raid of the Air Temple and beginning of the war undercuts Aang's journey because he has to learn this. And we as the audience should go on that emotional journey with him.
Mm.
Aang just accepting that he's the Avatar and training by the end of the episode also undercuts his journey because he still wants to go have fun. The whole reason they go to Kyoshi Island where they meet Suki and they have that little adventure is because he wants to go ride some giant koi fish. Like, he still wants to like enjoy the world. He doesn't fully grasp what the Fire Nation has done to the world. And so Aang just being like, I'm the Avatar. I have the responsibility. Let's go do this thing. It doesn't work because it takes the joy out of Aang. It takes the childlike joy that he has in life. Because one of the things that he has that he's supposed to do to people is instill hope in them. But him just being very stoic and like, I'm sorry I wasn't here. I'm going to fix it. That doesn't work. That doesn't bring hope.
Okay.
If by more mature content, because the original creators were brought onto this project and they left due to creative differences because of quote unquote mature content. It seems like it's because they really wanted us to see the Fire Nation immolating people. That happens a lot.
That was pretty brutal.
And they seem to enjoy it. Those showrunners, they linger on it a lot. Like, we see Monkey Atso and many airbenders get immolated. And maybe even some kids, like, I know it's implied, but like, I can't remember if like some younger kids or older kids get shown being killed. The visuals were solid. It's not a terrible first episode other than, again, lingering on the immolation. It still feels very surface level because they have to speed run all this stuff. And my big nitpick for that episode is Gran feels like a crazy stalker bitch. Episode two. Much better overall product. The stunt performances remind me of Ahsoka. Very stiff action. Zuko feels more desperate than determined. Big nitpick for this episode is, again, streamlining Aang's character arcs is hurting Aang's story. He comes across as an anti-Peter Parker, which I mentioned earlier. Episode 3. Clunky combination of at least 4 episodes. The Water Scroll and Pirates. Jet, which, ugh, fuck Jet. In any iteration, that character is the worst. The mechanist and his handicapped son who flies around, and which, were you able to see the airbender that they were talking about in that episode where he's like, I think there's an airbender. Look over there. There's an airbender. I did not see shit.
I have no idea.
Like, did they forget to put something in? They forget to put a VFX shot in.
I think so. Because I know he said it, but I'm like, was that supposed to be like a diversion or something? Like, what was the point of that? I didn't get that.
So in the animated series, they live in another air temple and they live up in a mountain with air currents and stuff, which is how he's able to fly.
Mm-hmm.
How the hell is he taking off from the ground at Omashu?
I don't know.
Where? How? Is someone taking him up the mountain to like push him off? Like, trust me, I'll be fine. Just push me, man.
I've tried this before.
Danny Pudi as the mechanist, though, was really good.
Yes.
I appreciated him. And then the story of Omashu getting to Omashu. Mm-hmm. There's 4 episodes that they just bunched into that one. And it does not work. Mainly because the Jet storyline, which again, ugh. Jet storyline is undermined because the idea of Jet and his little gang of not so merry children is that they are willing to make sacrifices that include non-Fire Nation civilians. In his storyline, they're planning to burst a dam on a town that the Fire Nation is inhabiting, but there are still civilians living there. And that's when Katara and everyone's like, oh, Jet's a bad guy.
No, see, they're not willing to make sacrifices. They're willing to sacrifice others. There's a bit of a difference.
Yeah, and they're setting off bombs in like empty warehouses or warehouses that they have discovered have Fire Nation spies. Yeah. So there's intent with the terror they're causing. But it's not as brutal as beating up an old man walking down the street because they think he's Fire Nation.
Yeah.
It's not as brutal as willing to kill an entire town just because there are 20 Fire Nation guards stationed there. Yeah. So it undercuts that the impact of that story, but also just making me think of Jet. Just that's one thing you can cut from this show, and it doesn't affect anything. Aang is still very joyless in episode 3. Big nitpick is the bending choreography is still very clunky. Positive thought: Zhao's adaptation is pretty good. Aang versus Zuko in the market is not great, but at least they were trying something as well. Like, I will give them credit for trying something.
But the cabbages.
Which they brought back the cabbages voice actor for that. Episode 4, the Boomy storyline, being another speedrun victim is upsetting. By the end of the episode, I did turn around on it a little bit because I see what they're going for, but I don't think it's translated well. They really needed to give an origin story to Katara's water canteen. But in this show, she just has one at some point. But in this one, she's like, oh, water canteen. This could be useful. They have time to do the hippies in the tunnel with the secret tunnel song, but they don't have time to properly characterize Boomy. Sokka solving the secret tunnel riddle rings very hollow because the idea is sibling love solves the problem, but not really, because it's a mess of what the show is trying to do. And the fact that they say the badger moles can feel emotion from the beings around them is stupid. When Iroh gets captured, or when Iroh's being transported by the Earthbenders, that is probably the worst translated portion of Iroh from the show so far. Mm. Because one of the things that it makes Iroh in the show is his loss at Ba Sing Se. He lays siege to it for over 600 days. The city cannot fall. He's had this dream as a child that he was going to siege and claim Ba Sing Se. And so he laid siege to it for 600 days. He didn't do it, came back home, lost his mantle as heir to being the Fire Lord. And in this moment when he's being transported in the animated series, he's like, I acknowledge my defeat at Ba Sing Se. You guys were better for that 2 years that I tried to sack your city and I couldn't. I've moved on. I'm trying to be a better person. But in this, he's just very sullen and quiet. Like he's not respecting the Earthbenders, because that's one of the things that makes Iroh so interesting, is that especially in season one, he is Zuko's lieutenant. He is his right hand man. And Zuko is very much Fire Nation is the best nation. We will bring peace to the world by dominating it. And Iroh is just kind of like, I'm with you, my dude. But then you see this other side of him where he's respecting all these other cultures. And it's like, where is this dude coming from? What is this? But in this, he's just very much like, Zuko's my boy. Let's just move on. We get the funeral scene with Iroh's son. And they're trying to make me feel something with the musical theme that they play there, Little Soldier Boy.
Yeah.
When you watch one of my least favorite episodes of The Last Airbender animated series is Tales of Bot. Well, I shouldn't know. It's not one of my least favorites. There are certain parts of it that are my least favorite, but I think it's the final vignette that they have from Tales of Ba Sing Se is Iroh having this beautiful day out in the neighborhood. He helps some kids. He helps some kids get into mischief. He helps a little girl like sew up her doll, makes a little baby stop crying, gets complimented by the mom. And he's just being jovial and wonderful. And at the end of the episode, we find out that he's going to have a picnic so he can mourn his son on his son's birthday. And he sings him a song, and it is heartbreaking, and you cry every damn time. They try to play with your emotions by playing the Little Soldier Boy theme in twice in that episode. And I was like, you're not getting me. This is a shitty ass episode. when Iroh gets stabbed, they're firebenders. They can cauterize the wound. But they're like, God, we gotta get you on the ship. You're gonna bleed out. Like, cauterize it. Like, that should be firebending day two. Like, oh, someone gets a wound. I will have to disagree with you. I think episode 5 with Heibei is the best episode as far as like translating the show. The very next episode is more disappointing, but I liked a lot of the stuff that they did in this episode. Heibei looks amazing. The Aang bringing his friends along on the journey, I think, is an interesting twist on the story that they bring in, because in the animated series, Sokka gets taken by Heibei, and we just don't see Sokka, and Aang goes on a spirit world journey. But I think episode 5 is, for anyone who has watched the animated series, that's the best episode they have on this 8-episode season 1. Episode 6 is okay. The meeting up with Roku, I think, was cute, but it's really janky and forced and rushed. I think episode 5 is also where we meet June and her Shirshu. Episode 6, we see June again. We see the flirting. The lack of resolution with the Heibei spirit is very disappointing, because that's one of, again, one of the more hopeful moments in the animated series, because we see Heibei as this monster throughout this entire, I think it's a 2-part episode. And when we come back to Heibei and Aang shows Heibei the acorn, it's like, it's going to grow into a tree and this whole forest is going to regrow and it's going to be beautiful. Heibei calms down and turns into a giant panda.
Really?
Yeah. It's a beautiful little panda, or giant panda. And it's very docile. And it's like, yeah, okay, cool. I see what you're saying, man. And he goes on with his life. But like, we see, like, it shows us what the spirits can do, because when they're calm and when they're peaceful, they present themselves as like animals that we recognize. But when they're angry and when they're upset, they transform into these monsters. Interesting. And in episode 5, we see like Heibei's got like this scratch on his face and all these other things, but we get nothing out of it. There's nothing that comes from introducing Heibei other than fans of the animated series get to see what that live action interpretation of the Heibei angry spirit looks like. Everything else from that point on revolves around Ko and Aang learning more from Roku. And it's really disappointing that Aang does not get to give hope even to the spirits. Because again, Aang is supposed to be a symbol of hope.
Okay.
Last two episodes here. Episode 7, Katara and Paku's beef is undercut, and the fight feels like the most heartless thing in this adaptation. They just wanted to recreate moments and went along with it. Conclusion is bad. Zhao's adaptation continues to be interesting and probably the best long-form part of this adaptation. Azula being introduced throughout the series and like her little tests with Ozai is dumb. Episode 8, Zhao's death is dumb because he's supposed to die from his hubris. He's not supposed to die from Iroh murdering him.
Okay, I can see that.
Iroh is not supposed to intentionally harm anyone beyond just like defeating them in battle, because it undercuts who he is at this point in his life. So making him kill Zhao in protection of Zuko is stupid, because there's so much I don't want to spoil for people, because my ranking is watch the animated series. I think if you don't like animation, but you want to see some cool kung fu action, this is good enough. But the animated series is so damn good. So last few notes from episode 8, Azula playing Game of Thrones, not interesting. It's derivative and it's dumb. Also, the way they took Omashu is stupid, because Omashu is, because of who Bumi is and how eccentrically brilliant he is, he says, lay down your arms, let him come in. We're not going to win. We will win another day.
Really?
Yeah. And it's like no casualties, no loss of life, but because they're so obsessed with showing how brutal the Fire Nation is, we have to show them in all their Nazi glory and do all the like, oh no, it's so dark and grim and so much despair and lack of hope. Whatever will they do? they have Aang, and they have a zany group of characters around Aang that will save the world, because that's the point of the show.
Hmm.
But they don't, there's just something missing in all of that. Yue's death is not impactful at all, because they didn't bother taking the time to set up the relationship with Sokka. Yue's death is heartbreaking because people, namely someone we love in Sokka, cares about her deeply. Sokka only cares about becoming a warrior, and he's upset that he's stuck on bodyguard duty, right, and that he met this lady in the spirit world once.
Yeah, during that part, when you know they'll murder the moon, my wife was going, "Well, they can bring it back." I'm like, "Hmm?" And she's like, "Yeah, they already established she has a bit of it in her. She's, you know, she just needs to give that up." No, I did not expect her to die and become the moon, but that did more and more seem a very, very obvious solution.
And in this, Sokka does not care. He only cares because he failed in his mission. He doesn't care because someone he loves died, right, yeah, or sacrificed themselves so that they can live. It rings hollow, and it doesn't work even more so because in the animated series, her dad reveals to Sokka that when she was a baby, she was sickly, she was going to die. He was visited by the moon spirit and said, gave him a vision that his daughter would become the moon. Aww. And so Sokka, in his own way, helped her fulfill this prophecy, this destiny for Yue.
Okay.
But it means nothing in this, especially without the symbolism that they put with Yue, because in the show, we get a flashback where we see this sickly baby with dark hair. And when the moon spirit touches her, her hair turns white. She's healthy, bouncy baby girl, happy, loving life. And when she gives up her spirit to become the new moon spirit, her hair turns black again as the life leaves her. It's beautiful. Like, that's the one thing that the M. Night Shyamalan movie got really right. Is like, you can see, you can like, it's like a reverse flare where you see like the light dim from her head and it becomes black hair instead of white. And they didn't do a wig as well. The wig is atrocious.
That wig is really bad. There's some very, very questionable facial hair prosthetics and wigs.
And then the last thing I have is Aang's journey continues to be less and less hopeful. He's supposed to have learned waterbending by this point. Like, he's not supposed to be a master at it. That's part of his journey with Katara in season two, is that they have to build this relationship that's not just about them being friends, but also a master and apprentice relationship. They have to find that boundary, while also Aang has to learn the other elements in season two, it's Earth. So it becomes much more about what does it mean to be your teacher's, the friend of your teacher? And what does it mean to be the friend of your student between Sokka and Aang? But that's something they could still get into, but it's undercut a lot by some of the stuff that they're already doing in the show.
Okay. Prediction. Based off what you just said, and I'm going to go full on stereotypical, the way any writing works. Aang and Katara are going to get together, aren't they?
Yes.
Okay. Yeah, that's what I thought.
To go back to your question about Sokka, as far as I'm aware, we have no answer to whether or not Sokka bore any children. Okay. I believe it's confirmed that he and Suki got married, but I think that might have been a doomed relationship. Like, they might have gotten divorced or something might have happened. It's left very vague.
Oh.
But I believe they're doing a movie, a trilogy of movies regarding the more adult, like young 20 something Team Avatar.
Okay. All right.
But I believe that's supposed to be for like Paramount Plus. I don't know if it's supposed to be theatrical. So those are my notes as someone who I have religiously watched the entire run of Avatar: The Last Airbender at least once a year, if not once every 2 years, since like 2010. And there's still details and lore that I'm not familiar with, but I also watched Legend of Korra. I watched that less frequently only because there are issues I have with Korra being very stagnant character.
Mm.
She has really good moments, but then they just go back to square one with her.
So your yearly rewatch of the Avatar series is my yearly rewatch of the Matrix trilogy and Animatrix.
All right. So, Alex, what would you say is Avatar The Last Airbender Netflix edition? Is it a must-see or a pass?
I actually enjoyed it. And so it's a must-see, especially since it's been canceled. You know, they renewed it for seasons 2 and 3 and promptly canceled it. So we're going to get the ending, you know, which is good. And that's really all I can expect. I'm going to be very curious as to how they handle the, you know, it's, they filmed it like 3 years ago. They are doing season 2 and 3 back to back because they're trying to keep the kids from aging out. So we're going to see what happens. I'm hopeful that with some,
unlike Aang.
Yeah. Hopeful that, you know, we get some maturity. I would like to see Suki back. I want to see where the direction goes with the prince, because to me, it's
Zuko's fairly... journey is so good. I mean, I understand you want to watch the show, but it's going to take us 4 years to get this, to get seasons 2 and 3. Like, they'll probably release season 2 in 2027, 2028 after all the VFX are done. And then they'll do season 3 either later that year or early 2029.
So
watch the animated series and get the full enjoyment of these characters. Cause if you like Suki, if you like Zuko, you don't even know Mei and Ty Lee. Really? Those are Azula's two little friends that are with her, Mei and Ty Lee. I don't even think they name them in the show. They're all amazing.
Okay. Does June come back?
June, I believe, is in 3 or 4 episodes, and she comes back by the end of season 3 as well.
Okay, then I will watch it, because June is,
which,
the
again,
best.
Voiced by Jennifer Hale, so bonus points.
So give me your rating, because I have now one additional thought that I want to ask you as the credits are rolling.
My rating is pass.
Oh.
It's mainly because I think I figured out why they do this thing, besides the fact that Netflix gets people talking about it, and it rakes in people viewing it. My mother-in-law reached out to Ricky and she was like, oh yeah, we started watching the new Avatar The Last Airbender. They did such a good job updating the movie. And I wanted to throw something. Because that's what they're making these adaptations for. That is who they're making these adaptations for. Is people like my in-laws, particularly my father-in-law, who does not like animated stuff. They will refuse to watch animated things because animation is for children in their eyes. And it just got my blood boiling, because they're only, Ricky tried to get them to watch Avatar. When we first moved in together, I sat her down and we watched the box sets. I had the DVD box sets. I went out and bought those after I binged them on Netflix, because I was like, I don't know how long this is going to be on Netflix. I bought the box sets and we watched them. No, it was even before we moved in together, because she was still living at home and her dad was pirating rentals onto a hard drive. And so I let her take the DVDs and he moved them onto his hard drive and he just never watched them. She tried to get them to watch, but he just was like, oh, it's a cartoon. No, I'm not going to watch this. I'll steal them, but I won't watch them.
Oh, that's funny.
But just watch the animated series. That's my rating.
Okay.
The animated series is so much better. And because it's animated, there's not as much inconsistency in the visual representation of things. And when you get to the end of season 1, where the moon goes out, oh my God, that's so beautiful. It is such an amazing animation. And the way they play with the colors, but it comes back in season 3 where a certain firebender gets rainbow fire. And it's amazing.
All right.
So watch the animated series. Final time I'll say it. All right, Alex, let everyone know about our Discord.
Our Discord is amazing. You want to be there for conversations, to prompt us to give our thoughts and opinions. For us to not be mean like the video game club and call you morons for being wrong. We're just going to write a diatribe and let you know why.
I take the Weekly Planet Nick Mason approach. Like what you like, It's fine. It's cool. But you're wrong. But like what you like. All right, Alex, also, who is remixing our musical themes this week?
Oh, Billie Eilish, fresh off of her Oscar win from tonight.
I don't know what you're talking about. Godzilla Minus One won all the Oscars.
It's true, but he handed her one briefly for a moment and then took it back.
He went, screonk, here you go. Don't forget, we also have our sweepstakes going where you can submit a Talking Smackdown submission and submit a submission, a Talking Smackdown suggestion. You can email us at tsmackpod@gmail.com and we will enter you in for a drawing to win a Steam copy of Marvel's Midnight Suns. Mm-hmm. You can find us on social media at Talking Smack Pod on Blue Sky, Instagram, Threads, Hive Social, Post News, Facebook, YouTube, TikTok, and Lonnie's website. Again, you can email us at tsmackpod@gmail.com. Thank you to Leo Allen for musical themes, Beppo and Rich Royal Studios for our avatars, no pun intended. Please like, subscribe, rate, review on your podcatcher of choice. Those ratings go a long way. Thank you so much for listening. Alex, thank you so much for being here and wasting 8 hours of your life watching this show. But most importantly, everyone, again, thank you so much for taking the time to listen to us rant and rave about things. Please take care. Have a great week. We will see you next week when we talk about
something. So the prince becomes an ally, right?
He becomes... Yeah. You gotta watch the animated series.
I will.
Just watch it.
They made him too sad sap to not become an ally.
Watch Avatar The Last Airbender, the animated series.
Right after Star Trek.
Star Trek, the animated series.
Oh. Lower Decks.
Who loves T-Smack?
I love T-Smack. Is it true? Mm-hmm. I do, ooh.